pharmaceutical commercial breakfast is going to be coming up on Joe Weider. It is 3:09 p.m. on Thursday, March 4th, 2021. Today, I am hearing this meeting from Davis Room 106. Members present are Representative Snyder, Kulture, Representative Fields is on the line, Representative Stronghold is on the line, Representative McCarthy, Representative Cox, Representative Kirka, and myself, Representative Zalas. I'd like to begin by thanking our House Record staff for their pressure and allowing staff who are such a for moderating today's meeting. But the record reflects that we have a quorum to conduct business. Today, we are returning to House Bill 76, Governor Bellamy's bill to extend the COVID-19 disaster declaration. I believe we have our committee substitute for introduction. Yes, thank you, Rep. Snyder, Chairs of Procedure, I move that the Health and Civil Services Committee adopt the committee's substitute for HB 76, Work Order Number 32-GH1011/B, as a working document. I will object for the purposes of discussion. Representative Snyder, if you can walk us through the bill and the changes in the proposed coding system. Thank you. So, this version of committee section HB 76 is similar to SB 56, version D, from Senate Labor and Commerce. It incorporates the following changes. One, it adds a section requiring health care providers to obtain informed consent before administering a COVID-19 vaccine. It allows for individuals to object to the administration of a COVID-19 vaccine based on religious, medical, or other grounds. And it protects individuals from liability for an action that does not comply with the order after the expiration of the original declaration and before the enactment of this law. Additionally, it adds legislative findings that it is in the best interest of the state to continue having the appropriate tools and taking the correct steps forward to contain the spread of COVID-19 and distribute COVID-19 vaccines. Lastly, it adds language in SB 241 that limits the governor's appropriation authority to those detailed in the financing plan. It essentially overrides AS 26.23.050 and makes it clear that the governor may only appropriate funds that are in HB 76. I'll finish with a comment here. The committee substitute HB 76 maintains the September 30th, 2021 expiration date. We did a great job responding to COVID-19 and managing challenges. This is largely due to the appropriate tools and flexibility the original disaster declaration gave us. We need to continue having these tools so we can anticipate the impacts and react quickly and appropriately. This bill provides for that. Are there any questions from committee members on the committee substitute?
Through the chair, can you hear? Well, so through the chair, that bill that came from the governor, that the commissioner stated that there's no more need for that because it's not an emergency. That fits with that. That's in this language, which is a capital E. There is, there's a small aim in your definition what that meant. But if there's no disaster to that, what are we substituting for if there's not a disaster in this situation?
Sure, great question. And I can take a stab at this. The intention is to bring alignment from the existing working document that's before us to align it with the work that was done in Senate Health and Social Services as well as Senate Labor and Commerce, so that they're truly companion legislation. And then beyond that, the conversation or the discussion today, we will be hearing from health stakeholders, healthcare stakeholders, as well as community stakeholders on what they're seeing in the field with regard to the ongoing pandemic. So today's adoption of a committee substitute only adopts it as a working document and does not give any sort of sense of commitment to passage or anything of that sort, but just updates the working document.
Yeah, to follow up to a good point question.
isn't dimension in section 3 dot space $20 million between all four regions and Department of Social Services. And that's on page 4. And then on page 5 it says government may not expend more than $10 million on their disaster relief fund. So there's a total of $30 million in spending authorization. Would that be correct?
Can you kind of the page number that you're looking at, which one?
Page 4, section 3A1 is line 18. This is the authorization in section 1, chapter 8, SLA 2020. Department of Social Services allowing for up to $20 million in transfers between all corporations made in the Department of Social Services, except for transfers from the Medicaid services office. And then on page 5, it says at line 10, the governor may not expend more than $10 million of state funds from the disaster relief fund. So it appears that the authorization is for a total of $30 million.
Is that a question
that
you think is better than props?
Thank you, Chair. But that language was in that which was came from the governor's office in the original 70 cents. So you're correct in that bill. I just received this piece. Your government has received the whole thing, so I just received a few minutes ago. But that I do remember from the last bill.
Any questions
at this time? Yeah, okay. Thank you for the quick sense, Robert. Can you just update your percentage points? Yes, that doesn't necessarily include substitute. It could be the original bill. On page 10, starting at line 9, in personal objectives to the administration of the vaccines, says an individual may object to the administration of COVID-19 based on religious, medical, or moral grounds. And it's a, and I think it probably would be worth doing a comprehension. It would seem that an individual already has the right to do that. And I'm just philosophically uncomfortable with the state permitting someone to do something to which they already have a right to do it. So could we get clarification, I guess, from legal of why this is included?
We can do that. I did want to add that that reflects an amendment from Senate 5 in Health and Social Services. That was amended before our Senator Manhold and added. Well, we can certainly follow up.
Okay. Thank you. And if you want to follow up, starting on line 18, civil liability, a person may not be held liable for an action taken on or after February 14th, 2021, and before the effective date of this act, that complies with or does not comply with any other proclamation or declaration adopted by another. On the one hand, it is making this apply for things that happened after February 14th. The other, I think, I would like to get a legal opinion on it, maybe I need continue to exempt people from adverse reactions to the vaccine, should there be any, or whatever else they do as far as that goes, that if someone was in fact negligent for some reason, they would still be exempt. And that too, I guess, makes me uncomfortable. I understand the reason for it, but we need to make sure we understand what's going on.
Sure. So, I just want to clarify for the education of the community that adopting the CS again is not aspect of legislation, and this legislation will be before this body to consider amendments as well as to have time to get legal clarification from legislative legal. So, any action in adopting the CS is solely to adopt it again as a working document to be amended and considered by this committee. And so, getting into the particulars of how does not have to happen today.
I'm for the opportunity to address the board tonight. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Are there any questions from the members? Seeing none at this time, Mr. Thompson, if you don't mind standing on the line in case there are questions from subsequently, we would appreciate it.
Thank you for the question.
During the fishing season, in the past, during the legislature working to make the importance of THC flexibility a permanent policy. The THC provides flexible options for the process, and we are still on to provide needed time to support the legislative process for those other initiatives. The THC allows for rapid procurement and hiring for the response of the essential elements when it comes to the effective vaccine distribution plan and enabling us to set up community mass vaccine clinics quickly and put shots in purpose. It also provides for the flexibility of the delivery of healthcare, such as telling us to help keep our patients and providers safe and maximizing our workforce in Alaska through expedited and courtesy licensing. Our court testing has protected our rural communities and it has helped to ensure the health of our communities from the new variant from the balance. It has also allowed for the mobilization of the National Guard to assist with testing, administration, contact tracing, and distribution of the life-saving vaccines, which have been securing our state's return to the normal. Finally, under the disaster provisions in Alaska Statute 2623-02-G, Section 10, can the governor allocate and redistribute food, water, fuel, clothing, medicine, or supplies, which includes the scarce vaccine allocations and therapeutics being used to treat COVID-19, such as monoclonal antibodies. Since the federal health emergency ended on February 14th, we have seen communities miss vaccine distributions due to the inability to mobilize the National Guard. We have seen the closure of the state's largest drive-through testing site and are again seeing an increase in COVID-19 cases. We have seen cases begin to rise for states rising of THC back to about September 2020 levels, which is following a trend that we are seeing nationally and which the CDC warned about. And I'd just like to close with our strong support of this bill and we hope that we can get from this. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carter. Are there any questions from committee members? Or can I
thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm just wondering if I haven't been following this real close for the last altercation decisions, other things, but I wonder if you could tell me whether the telehealth providers that you're using, are they in-state or are you using out-of-state telehealth providers as well?
Thank you, Chair. Representative Cox, thank you for the question. I can go back and get more details on that. However, the Alaska Tribal Health System has had a well-established telehealth program that has been developed over several decades that we have been able to expand and utilize to greater detail during the pandemic. In some of our communities, those have increased by 400%. As far as the actual providers, we will double go back and get that information and submit it back to the community.
Thank you. That would be interesting. I'd like to add another. I'm wondering if there is, I suppose there is testing at most of the village airports. Some of them are pretty small. Do you know whether all of the village airports are providing testing services?
Dr. Chair, Representative Fox, thank you. I do not know if the federal health organizations in the health communities have had testing sites put forward. But again, these without the public health emergency sites, the testing is not mandated. It is only recommended. And with the recommendations, it really leaves exposure to our communities. The communities have limited ability for quarantining and
some of the rural communities, I think, at least can have powers, but some of them have been imposing their own restrictions on travel into the communities. Is that still the case, or is that going to miss out with the expiration of the emergency?
Thank you, Chair. Each of these communities are sovereign and are able to self-determine the level to which they are opening up their communities for travelers, and for each are taking the project that are appropriate to their own communities. However, some communities are second class cities, and they do not have the public health authorities in order to exercise up to the same level and degree with those types of measures.
Thank you so much, Ms. Barnett, for your testimony before the committee today. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Next up is Phil Hofstetter from the Petersburg Medical Center. Mr. Hofstetter, if you could please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, good afternoon. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you sound great.
Hey, for the record, I'm Phil Hofstetter, CEO of Petersburg Medical Center. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm testifying in support of Education Research for Medicine Provider. On February 6th, I submitted a letter of support to the Senate HHS Committee to extend the emergency declaration to April 56. At that time, I had started supervising at the healthcare facility in Arusk to adequately respond to COVID if the declaration expires. What I'd like to do today is explain what happened since April 14th after April 56 expired. This graph I sent to the committee this morning to easier visualize these events. I want to ask the committee if they receive a copy of that.
Yes, and it's put up on the screen. Thank you.
Thank you. So approximately 1 week after April 56 expired, we experienced COVID 12. Over 60 cases in 7 days. And leading up to that expiration of April 56, we saw a noticeable behavioral difference within the community, with increased public and private social activities in bars, restaurants, reduced masking indoors in public places, and certainly bypassing testing at the airport. And of note, we did have in place local mandates to support those, but this was not to consideration. We had more cases in 7 days than we saw the full year since we stood up our emergency operations last March. Our team has spent countless exhausting hours to staff up and mitigate a response in the past 2 weeks during this outbreak. Financially, we spent approximately $250,000 towards the outbreak alone. Schools moved to online and businesses closed. But the increased cases we have seen for additional admissions, we have 11. And publications, CDC, Harvard Health. We have used 14 medical antibiotic treatments, and we've kept over 700 people. Prior to the outbreak, we only had 2 days of school closure, otherwise it's been out in person. As an island community, the mandates for testing, interstate travel prevented community spread. Largely, this is the only way COVID can enter our community. Testing travelers is a first line of defense to prevent COVID from entering and spreading in our community. The emergency declaration is clearly needed to stem further outbreaks from occurring. I have a front row seat to COVID in the rural community, and I can tell you it's much too soon to allow the rest of the outbreak efforts to come out of the pandemic. Thank you.
Mr.
Hofstetter, other questions from committee members? Sorry, Mr. Clark, I want to remember you mentioned, Phil, on the number of hospitalizations.
We had 4 inpatient admissions.
Okay. How many beds do you have available? Excuse me. Yes. How many? Thank you, Manager. And to the chair, how many beds are available?
COVID beds, we have about max right now. The COVID beds differ from personal hospital beds because we have to have greater pressure, inadequate PPE, inadequate staffing to maximize those.
Yes, thank you, Manager. So, you're saying you only have 4 COVID beds, but the other beds in the hospital you have are available for COVID patients, right? You're saying, if I understand correctly.
Well, absolutely. We have 1 room allocated to COVID for COVID check, COVID response, for negative pressure rate. So the 48 appear all at once. So we are very limited in the way we can treat COVID patients in the hospital.
Mr. Hofstetter, if I understand your response correctly, this is Representative Lasky. Petersburg has the resources to treat religious centers, is that correct?
Yes, I clarify. So we have 12 inpatient beds in our hospital as a critical access hospital. Our bed capacity does not dictate the severity of treatment or care, I should say. We have one allocated or dedicated room, we have a negative pressure room, and safe parking place for a COVID patient. We can expand those rooms as needed. However, what our biggest limiting factor in our hospital is staff. So, for every COVID patient is probably twice the staffing, twice the time, because of the burnout that they need to make sick patients. So, in addition, when we're doing local data collection, is we also have to use our dedicated room in our facility, because that's an infusion, which is, takes an hour of outpatient treatment within the facility, when we need it. So the room itself is not actually a good picture of the breadth or the depth of how we take care of patients. If we have any more than 2 or 3 admissions, then we would, then obviously we need to know about how, but the primary,
thank you for
that. Thank you, Dr. Bob. Thank you, Dr. Chair. I'm just going to pass that right on. If you're coming before the community, I know that you're busy, that it's challenging time. So you said that Dr. Bob is actually the virus that's spread. You have 9 cases in 7 days than you've had in the previous year. Can you talk a little bit about the impact of not being able to require people that testing how in your community people that live on an island understand what that means?
Absolutely. Thank you. I have done it right. My wife works up at the airport of the testing tent and help. And so anecdotally, again, she had mentioned to me that since the expiration of SB56, people simply just got that because it's not mandated. Even though it's local mandates, there's nothing really enforcing that mandate. And the lack of the state support certainly had a behavioral effect within travelers. And that extended out into the community for, like I was mentioning, the bars and black restaurants, the East West, and things like that. But there was a rapid compliance with travelers, certainly, when Section 56 was spread.
Thank you. So it sounds like, you had a pretty significant change in people's behavior in the community, not only people's behavior as they were traveling into the community, but also folks that weren't leaving the community, their behavior was changing because they had, we don't have a public health emergency anymore, therefore you can go back to normal. Did you say that resulted in a school closure at some point in time?
Yeah, so the sequence of events, and we're working with public health to backtrack the exact sequence of events. But we had some travelers with COVID that left the tents, and obviously COVID is only coming in one way for travel, so it's in the community. That's increased in social activity for the public. Had a spreading factor within those units, and then as the expression occurred, the laxness was really obvious, and those units then went to bars and events in the community on sequential days, and then those also have an effect within our daycare and within our schools. And once it gets into a congregate setting, such as a school, daycare, it's, there's just no way to prevent some of the spread without closing schools.
what's the demographics of the members, or how you're collecting
information, whether it's anecdotal or if it's some other testing mechanism, real quick, you're saying that part.
Thank you.
the increased infection ratios of invariant link group will be 50% higher than the current circulating virus, opportunities will be even more devastated than they already are. Support is needed to continue our vaccination efforts and our broad-based testing strategy to mitigate virus recovery. I want you to thank the committee for their hard work on behalf of all residents, and I ask you to consider this call for continuation of the emergency preparation. We're happy to take any questions.
Why don't you take your testimony and then we'll take questions from both of you at the end.
Okay. From the market, Rudy James, we need the Vice President of Vestal Services for Newport Technical Field Compassion. And Brian Allen, Florida Hospital 76. You heard Dr. Hawkins talk about the medical side of this, but we're going to start with a little bit on one of the tools that we're using to help us manage our care, not just COVID, but health care in general. Some of the speakers have spoken about this earlier too, but that's kind of what kind of important that is. Early in the pandemic, we lost a lot of our air access, both by private airline shutting down, and by the restrictions on travel that were put in place, even in May when things were starting to break in us. Telehealth became a real tool for us to use, and we rapidly set that up to expand out to our villages. We have about 30,000 individuals in our service area. Many of us people depend upon telehealth and remote services to get the health care. And again, COVID is a big thing. We're talking about that, so it's really important that people can't get in to do their regular health care. Things get worse. So telehealth helps us to maintain our health and understand before somebody gets really bad. In order to do this, we have to be able to sustain this program. Part of that is what this bill allows us to do. So I am here in support of extending the bill. Appreciate the chance to testify. Appreciate the work on behalf of them. Thank you.
Thank you both. Are there any questions from community members?
Just to put this in context, in the Utah Investment Planning District, which are the health communities, if you would, please?
Thank you.
continuance
FEMA disaster declaration. How is it on the ground in terms of, as we heard Mr. Carson saying, hearing from people out in the field, can you describe what level of public health risk remains to necessitate a disaster declaration?
I think the level of public health risk is very, very high. We actually just have to consider that it's going to take us for our access to a lot of things, especially in a region such as ours, with a fragile access that cannot be easily overwhelmed. I'm also extremely concerned about the variants that are circulating in our state. The B117 variant, which is B1.1.2, the B1.1.3.5, which is B1.1.2, and of course the B1.1.2. Healthcare is a highly regulated industry. So I'd like to have added state disaster declaration that mirrors the federal disaster declaration, provided the regulatory and legal certainties that achieve the modified error of measures. We are committed to providing correct quality care and to recommend about patient impact as much as possible. The process introduced significant uncertainty by the already advancing and unprecedented times. Unfortunately, ending the state's civil health emergency disaster declaration has threatened to end the actual pandemic. We support the extension of the civil health emergency disaster declaration, and we appreciate the committee's work. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fox. For the purpose of our committee turning over to continue to hear from other presenters, but we will come back to questions at the end. So if committee members are just jot down their questions, we can circle back. Next, we will turn our attention to Dr. Tom Hennessy from the University of Alaska. Dr. Hennessy, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Charles Obrowski and Julia.
Yes, it's not great.
I have some thoughts about Alaskan Biolabs.
That's our pull up.
Thank you. For the record, Twitter members, my name is Charles Hennessy. I'm a medical doctor and an infectious disease epidemiologist. I work for the University of Alaska. I also advise the Municipality of Anchorage and COVID response. I'm speaking today in support of SARS-CoV-2. From a public health professional's perspective, I was very disappointed to see the emergency disaster declaration expire. We need every tool in the toolbox to help us fight COVID, but the declaration provided many of us with what were necessary. There's lots of good news about America's current nuclear vaccine supplies, and after a year of dealing with the destruction of COVID, really all of us are ready to get back to return to normal. We can't even wonder if we're done with the pandemic. But yesterday, CDC Director Lawrence issued a warning to our nation about how we're at a very pivotal point in the epidemic. We're letting down our guards results in a surge of cases, suffering, and death, and undoing months and months of progress. To illustrate her point, this slide shows in the red the rate of COVID cases nationally in the United States, where it peaked at the very top there on January 9th. But we've been enjoying a downward trend near our other low cost in the United States. Next slide, please. But highlighting this, we had a little delay. Can we move to the next slide? Okay, thank you. But highlighting this, and sort of in red, is the recent drop off in the decline of cases. We've leveled out over the last several weeks, and this is what the director was making reference to. Next slide, please. The likely reasons for this leveling out are decreased vigilance on the part of the public, not following through the public health recommendations, and an increase in the super transmissible virus variants, in particular with the name of the UK variant of B117, which, as other speakers today have alluded to, is really 1.5 times more transmissible, less than the lowest form of public health measures. It's estimated by the CDC that this will become the dominant strain in the United States in March, and has already heard a lot. This will further complicate our lives. But to make great progress, that's the national picture of what's going on in Alaska, and the next slide helps illustrate that. This graphic shows the COVID rates in the entire state of Alaska throughout the pandemic, and illustrates what we're seeing nationally, is that we've finally declined substantially since the end of December. We have stabilized over the last several weeks, and it flattened our curve, and we're still in the high red zone for case numbers, and we've heard testimony from Dr. Hodges about how that could have impacted rural Alaska. But that's the overall state picture, but the next slide illustrates four regions of concern that show the increasing problems that we're having with COVID rates increasing in several regions. So the upper left-hand panel shows the increase in case rates in Fairbanks. The upper right-hand panel shows the increase rates in the Mount Sea area. Southeast Alaska, the northern area, which is the Petersburg region, has increased dramatically, as we've heard from an earlier testimony, as well as the southeast region, and the southern region, where the
Thank you.
just for the edification of our committee, can you define how those regions were, what are the boundaries of those regions?
Also, the behavior of health regions defined by the state of Alaska. There are aggregated regions so as to provide regional information and not single to anyone community to protect pharmacy.
Thank you so much for that.
Thank you. I do two-day culture for the next five testing at work time. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you sound great.
Right, thank you. For the record, my name is Laura West. I am the president and CEO of the Florida Group. The first is a state of our association for Alaska and our company testing orders and our company. As the voice for the nonprofit sector, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the Florida Committee in support of House Bill 76, extending the disaster declaration for Alaska. I join my colleagues to request and say that you have heard from today and many others in support of a renewed disaster declaration to ensure that we can continue to address the public health crisis and keep our poverty within problems. But there may be hope on the horizon when you work on that. Use an analogy that isn't always difficult to do. I mean the declaration at this point is akin to stopping your penicillin 7-day regimen right as early because you're starting to feel better. The science and experts would not support that action as it creates unnecessary risk and worse yet, they might have to start over. We simply must stick to our prescription. We're asking for steady steps in time, and we're prosecuting interest every day. Those that are on the front lines, those that have served and promote the oppression today, and those who are doing advocates that the public health of our elections. No one is untouched by this pandemic, and now we are out of the situation. We are asking for change. I see you are hearing from nonprofits across the state that we must certainly in order to meet the essential needs of our elections right now. Simply put, we need to ensure the availability of widespread testing for elections and mandatory testing of travelers into our state to protect our family and our people. We need acceptable, testing vaccinations delivered efficiently and effectively statewide. We need the ability to provide direct healthcare and critical public services for telehealth, and we need to safeguard our food security system and for elections to reflect our family's return from care. All of these issues must remain a top priority for our state as they reach themselves at the intersection of public health and our economy. I recognize that at least some of the issues in the recent state declaration are being contemplated in separate pieces of legislation in both bodies. But taking each action one by one, day by day, puts bare arrests on this state unfairly and burdens the nonprofit and local governments and you, the state, who are responsible for the family safety and care of public arrests. As a state, we do not have the luxury of waiting weeks or months to provide the kind of certainty for statute that we need to continue to respond to this unprecedented public health and subsequent economic crisis. I still believe that the beneficial parts of the disaster declaration could be codified in the next step process. The urgency of an immediate solution remains paramount. To that end, I respectfully encourage you to take the necessary steps to reinstate an emergency declaration of at least 90 days that meets the needs of all persons and communities during this pandemic. The minimum of a 90-day window will at least provide a bridge for service continuity and greater stability to the safety net that is working endless days to help the residents impacted by this public health crisis. This bridge also gives you and lawmakers the opportunity to clarify the additional regulatory relief with our state. Additionally, the bridge will allow all of us to understand which of the regulations will be useful to serve Alaskans to remind them when it works, like access to telehealth and flexibility in remote work, and generally involving our land and our land communities to name a few. In short, extending the disaster declaration of something substantially similar is essential to continue to support the health sector, local government, and all of us. Not only responding to the public pandemic, but in establishing a solid foundation for what we all acknowledge will be a long journey of recovery. I urge you to act swiftly. Every day we wait, we see the sector's behavioral and physical health services and care at the exact moments we need them the most. And as we have heard today from Petersburg and the White Bay region, people are still having crisis. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We certainly are encouraged by the positive progress of our state legislative bodies and moving forward with an extension. Both of us are ready to support you in our efforts. And I'll say I have questions for the committee. Thank you for your service.
Thank you. So, just for our committee member, contribution by alcohol people who are online for alcohol testimonies. We did a substantial amount of coming this afternoon to provide feedback, but I did want to provide a little bit of opportunity for some question and answer. As a follow-up, my office is also able to provide follow-up contact information for all of the testifiers today, if that's what you desire for an offline conversation. Are there any questions that anyone would like to ask at this time? Hopefully I'm recording.
Actually, to the chair, are you suggesting that there's going to be discussion outside of the meeting that certain people testifying?
I'm just saying that we can provide contact information for anyone who you've heard an embedded testimony today if there's substantive questions that you would want to connect with them about after the meeting.
Okay. So those that are going to be testifying are going to be testifying, they'll still be testifying in future committee meetings?
For embedded testifiers, not necessarily. Are there any questions for any of the testifiers that we've heard today? I did have a question.
I do have lots of questions, but I'm looking to hear from the other people that will testify on one of you.
Great. I did have one quick question for Dr. Hennessy, if she's still on the line. One of the things that you mentioned at the end of your presentation was about what Alaska loses without a disaster declaration. Do you have a sense, simply because I know that you brought a bit of statistics, how quickly the state could become overwhelmed if there was a delay in genomic sequencing and there was widespread spreading of the different variants within Alaska? Is there any sense of how quickly
Thank you. Thank you.
secrecy law affect cultural violence and join the substantive period to review the store element of the future law in the government lifestyle crisis, especially for those who have been affected by the virus and suffering the first grade of kids. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Testimony this afternoon. That is all the time we have for today, and those were all of the testifiers that appear to have signed up on the bridge today. So we will return to public testimony on Saturday, March 6th. Thank you all for joining us. We appreciate all of the invited testifiers. We will be holding House Bill 76 over amendments to this piece of legislation, and again, for the committee, we will be looking from the committee substitute that was adopted earlier in the meeting. Amendments to this piece of legislation are due to my office by 12 p.m. on Monday, March 8th. Our next meeting will be on Saturday, March 6th at 3 p.m. We will return to House Bill 76 and also Executive Order 119 during Saturday's meeting. Please note that the Saturday morning budget subcommittee meeting has been canceled. The time is 4:51 p.m., and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is